suddenly we were heading toward Maine, and you and Dad kept saying what a great time we were going to have. But it sounded as if you were apologizing.
His mother nodded. All the guilts your father and I have piled up, Adam, his mother said, the sadness in her voice again.
What was the other time?
A scare like this. A witness before a congressional committee in Washington said that he had secret knowledge of a former newspaper man who had given earlier evidence. He said the newspaper man had vanished under mysterious circumstances, but was now an agent in the Northeast. This was all very vague, of course, but Gray felt that we should not take any chances. Again, we went on another vacation, this time to California, San Francisco, for a week. And it rained every day, and you had a cold and a fever. You were only 7 years old. Then it turned out that the witness had not been referring to your father at all, but to another newspaper man who had turned out to be an agent for the CIA. The doorbell rang. The tension again. His mother suddenly stiff like in a movie freeze frame. The key turned in the door, and his father stepped into the hallway. Good, Adam, he said. You're home. He looked at Adam's mother. You've told him? For the first time, Adam noticed crevices of age on his father's face, small chasms of hidden depths. His father advanced briskly into the living room. Look, he said, I think we can use a weekend away from Monument. Probably drive north. It's beautiful this time of year up there. We'll find a nice motel and maybe an old inn and have ourselves an old-fashioned New England dinner. He clapped his hands a couple of times, as if in anticipation of the trip ahead. As if it were really a pleasure trip. I think we can all use a change of scene. I know I can. And Adam, we can call the school from the road Monday and tell them you're taking the day off. That'll give us the rest of today, Sunday and Monday. And who knows, maybe we'll take Tuesday, too. His father's voice was buoyant, eager. And Adam suddenly realized, with a chill, the truth. His father was playing the game, not trusting the walls, acting as if no phone call had been received from Mr. Gray. His face was still haggard, and his eyes wary and haunted, and the bright, enthusiastic voice was a sharp contrast. Well, shall we pack? He said, turning to Adam's mother. She smiled wanly. I've already packed. I always keep the suitcases ready. His father walked over to Adam and put his arm around his shoulder. It's going to be all right, Adam, he whispered. Actually whispered, here in their own living room. What have they turned us into? Adam thought. What has Mr. Gray done to my father and mother to make this kind of thing possible? For the first time, the horror of their predicament became real to Adam. Let's go, his father said, his hand clutching Adam's shoulder, a deep sadness in his eyes. Okay, Dad, Adam said. His mother had already gone upstairs for the suitcases.
22nd interval. Do you wish to rest a while?
No. I want to get through it all. Finally. My head hurts, and I don't want a pill. I want to end it. Get to the end.
Let us proceed, then. Tape change. End OZK-014.
The motel is on the outskirts of Belton Falls, and I pedal toward the place. It's dark now, and I know it's dangerous being on the road without lights or reflectors and wearing a khaki jacket, but I'm in a hurry and don't want to walk. Every bone in my body seethes with pain and weariness, and my lungs burn and my hands and feet are freezing, but I go on pedaling. The cars sweep by, the headlights blinding me sometimes, and once in a while a horn blows at me, and the sound wails in the darkness. But I keep going.
It's only a half mile or so out of the town, across from a gasoline station. That's where the motel is. And now I remember its name, Rest-A-While Motel. And it has cabins, and my mother said, "Isn't this romantic?" And we stayed there. Most of the cabins were for two people, but they moved a cot in for me so that we could be together all night long. And I lay there in the cot and felt safe and secure, listening to my father snore and hearing my mother breathe, the way her breath fluttered a bit, as if a butterfly danced on her lips. So I dig in and pedal, past the stores and the houses, and a long warehouse that I pass as if it's a big silent ship, and a motorcycle roars past me and almost blasts me from the road. Then, finally, I see the lights of the gas station across from the motel, and my heart leaps and I yell, "Hooray! I have made it to the motel. I've come this far and nothing has stopped me. Nothing will stop me now. I'll sleep tonight in the cabin where I stayed last year with my mother and father, and I'll be secure and safe again, thinking of them. And then tomorrow, I will wake up and arrive in Rutterburg, Vermont, across the river." The motel is dark. The light above the sign isn't lit, and the sign swings eerily in the wind. The cabins have an abandoned look. Is the place closed for the season, like the ice cream stands along the way? I check the cabin that serves as the office, and it, too, is deserted. I park my bike and walk up to the office. The door is swinging slightly, unlocked. I push it open, and the smell of staleness fills my nostrils, the odor of something old and passed by. The streetlights throw a pale illumination into the office. Two chairs are piled on one another in a kind of obscene embrace. The desk is cluttered with newspapers and books and other debris as if someone abandoned it hurriedly. I wonder what time it is and where I can find another place to stay tonight. My head throbs and my body longs for rest. I won't need any medicine to sleep tonight. I take the two chairs apart and sit in one of them, resting for a moment. I am so weary. It is amazing to me how much the place has changed since last year. The cabin seems, or rather feels, as if it has been neglected for years and years. I think of how fast decay moves in, and it makes me shiver. I think of my pills, and wish for the thousandth time I had taken them along. I think of the stories of drug addicts who break into stores and murder other people to get their fixes, and I can understand them. Right at this minute, I would give anything to be folded into bed, the pills working their magic, soothing me. A sound breaks the silence. Somebody is outside, near the bike. I leap to my feet and stalk to the door, my legs protesting. A dog is poking his nose at the front wheel of my bike. A small dog, a cocker spaniel, frisky and energetic. I'm not afraid of cocker spaniels, and I chase it away. "Go on! Go on, get out of here!" I say. The dog studies me for a moment, and then lopes away, tail wagging. The service station attendant across the street is pumping gas into a car. He's a teenager, with long dark hair flowing to his shoulders. I would like to be like him, to have a job and perform it well and collect my pay at the end of the week and go out with a girl, like Amy. I envy him, and I don't even know him. I think about the friends he must have and his family. I feel alone. "Okay," I tell myself, "cut the crap, stop the self-pity. This gets you nowhere." The wind comes up and I shiver again, turning away from the service station across the street. The wind bangs the door to the office, and I see what I must do. Get something to eat, and then return here and sleep. I can curl up on the floor and prop a chair against the door, against the doorknob for protection, and sleep the night away. And then tomorrow, fresh and rested, I can make the last few miles to Rutterburg and get there in triumph, flying fast on the bike. Now I'll get something to eat and call up Amy Hertz and tell her my mission is almost accomplished, and then come back and sleep sweetly through the night. And then I have an even better idea. Why sleep in the cabin's office? Why not investigate the other cabins? Maybe they've left beds and mattresses and blankets there. I guide my bike to the first cabin and look in the window. The window is dirty, fly-specked, spotted. I squint and see a bed, the mattress naked and askew.
What the hell, as Amy would say. A mattress is better than a floor.
I walk across the street. The attendant is checking the oil in a car, probing around with a dipstick. Have you got a payphone? I ask. His long hair swirls as he lifts his head and looks at me.
No booth, he says. Just a phone on the wall.
He looks at me and my bike without interest. I don't represent potential profit for him. I walk across the grease-spotted pavement and enter the office. The smell of oil fills the air and old rubber. I see a vending machine with candy bars and figure that I will stock up for the evening. I read somewhere that chocolate gives you quick energy. The phone clings to the wall near the door that leads to the garage itself. I scoop out my change once more and insert the dime and wait for the operator. A man's voice says,
"Operator."
I pronounce the numbers carefully, exaggerating them, almost a burlesque, but I don't care. I don't want to risk another wrong number. The lights of passing cars flash by, and I realize that I could never have made it this far tonight alone, on the bike. The phone is ringing. Ringing. I lose count of the rings. And then...
Hello? Hello?
That same gruff, impatient voice. Not Amy's father. Not anybody I know. Hello? I say. Is Amy there? I feel ridiculous asking the question because I know it's futile. A pause, and then as if he's being very patient.
There's nobody named Amy here. You the kid called earlier? I'm telling you, there's no Amy here.
It's cold suddenly in the office. Look, mister, there must be some kind of mistake. Is this Monument, Massachusetts, 537-3331? Again, I pronounce the numbers carefully, enunciating with precision.
Yes, this is Monument, Massachusetts, 537-3331,
he says sarcastically, mimicking my voice. My hand trembles as it holds the phone. The office is getting colder, as if someone had just opened a door and allowed in the coldest air in the world.
Then there must be some mistake, I say.
Is it possible for the telephone company to goof that badly? Issue the same number to two different places in town?
Yeah, I guess there is, the man says. Look, kid, I've been holed up in bed with some kind of flu, and I don't appreciate being dragged to the phone like this.
Mister, I'm sorry to bother you, but 537-3331 is a right number. It's the number of a family by the name of Hertz, and I've been calling it for the past 6 months. I called it yesterday, for crying out loud. The cold has invaded my body now, seeped into my bones, a cold like no other I have ever felt, penetrating, relentless.
Look, kid, the phone company doesn't make that kind of mistake. This is Monument, Massachusetts, and my number is 537-3331. I've had it for 3 years, and I don't know any Hertz family.
I am trembling all over now. I should have taken the medicine this morning. I shouldn't have thrown it away. I manage to say, "Thank you." Before he hangs up, he says,
"Try directory assistance. Just don't ring this number anymore."
I see the phone book dangling from a chain. I open it. I find the number for directory assistance. My hands shake, but I find another dime and put it in the slot. I have never been so cold in all my life, but it's a cold coming from inside. I dial the numbers. 1. And the area code. 617. And the rest of it. 555-1212. Directory assistance, what city? The voice is like a sound from a machine. Monument, I say. I tell her the name, Hertz, and the address, and I wait. And I am surprised that my hand is so steady holding the phone when the rest of my body is trembling. Hertz, she says. There's a Hertz rent-a-car on Main Street, but no other Hertz in Monument. Was that the right spelling? H-E-R-T-Z? Thank you, I say, and hang up. I watch my hand replacing the receiver, and it's as if I'm caught in some kind of slow-motion film. The man had said 537-3331 had been his number for 3 years. 3 years! I turn away from the telephone and begin to move, and I find that it's hard to place one foot in front of the other. The attendant turns his head as I approach. He is wiping the windshield. There's a woman in the car. Her face is distorted by the liquid that's been sprayed on the windshield. Yeah? The attendant asks, not really interested. He's chewing gum, and his jaw moves languidly. Who has slowed up everything? The world is in slow motion. How long's the motel across the street been closed? I ask, trying to hurry the words, but it's hard to talk in slow motion. He looks at me funny. Strange, I mean. And the woman's face is still distorted as she squints through the windshield. I look across the street at the cabins, and the attendant also looks. Oh, hell. 2-3 years, I guess, at least. He begins to wipe the windshield again. I touch his shoulder. It's an effort to raise my hand to his shoulder, but I do it anyway, slowly and carefully. The cabins weren't open last summer? I ask, saying the words carefully, not wanting to say the wrong words. He stops wiping the windshield now and stares at me. I don't like the stare. There's something strange in the stare, as if I'm alien. A visitor from another planet, another galaxy. The woman pokes her head out the window. Her hair is gray, but she has Orphan Annie eyes, wide, no lashes. She looks as if she has never blinked in her life. You all right? The attendant asks, and his eyes are wide too. His words don't seem synchronized with his mouth, as if a soundtrack has gone askew. Why didn't I take the pills this morning? Clutching the package with one hand and pushing the bike with the other, I start across the street. I can feel the attendant and the woman staring at me, their stares piercing the back of my head, but I don't turn back. A terrible sound fills my ears, like a cry of doom. My teeth suddenly hurt. My mouth is open, and the cold air bruises my teeth, causing them to ache. I try to close my mouth, but I can't do it. It's as if my jaw is locked, never to be closed again. And then I realize that the sound I hear is me. I'm screaming, and I can't stop. The sound is terrible. A car brushes past me, then another. Flash of lights, blare of horn. Hey, watch where you're going, someone calls. Finally, I am across the street, the bike, the package, and me. The grass is soft beneath my feet, and I think I have stopped screaming now, because everything is quiet. I check my mouth, and it's still open, but I'm not screaming any longer. I push toward the cabin where my mother and father and I stayed, all together, nice that night. The three of us together. I place the bike carefully against the cabin. I look across the street at the gas station, and the attendant is standing there looking at me. The orphan Annie woman is out of the car now and also looking. My mouth is still open, and maybe I'm still screaming. I turn away and beat at the cabin door, asking them to let me in, to please let me in. The darkness gathers me.
Tape change. Start tape OZK-015-2218. Date deleted. TA.
It was like an adventure in the beginning. The three of us going off in the car.
Although the day was dark and overcast, one of those muted October days when autumn's brilliant colors are suddenly subdued, Adam felt exhilaration as his father drove the car north, out of Monument into Fairfield, and across the New Hampshire line into Carver. They all sat in the front seat, a bit cramped, his mother in the middle, and this was the only disturbing note. "I think it might be better if we sit together," his father had said, and Adam felt a small shiver. Were things so bad that it was dangerous for one of them to sit alone in the back seat? It began to rain at one point, but this didn't dampen their spirits. The windshield wipers swung on the glass like a metronome, and Adam said, "Remember how we used to sing 'The Farmer in the Dell, Dad,' when I was just a little kid?" And his father began to sing, in his old raucous voice, and Adam joined in, and after a while his mother did too, shaking her head in assumed dismay. "There isn't anyone in this car who's on key," she said between the lines. "The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell." Later, when the rain had stopped and they were driving through Fleming, Adam said, "Suppose Mr. Gray is right, and those people, whoever they are, have found out who you really are, Dad. Does that mean we can't ever go back to Monument?" He thought of Amy Hertz, how he should have called her before leaving. The possibility of not ever seeing her again made him lonely. "We've had false alarms before, Adam," his father said. "Chances are this one is, too. Gray always looks on the dark side of things. That's what makes him so good at his job, I guess." "Look," his mother said, "let's not talk about all that. This is supposed to be a pleasure trip, a weekend away from Monument. Let's not talk about anything gloomy." So they drove, and his father recited some fragments of Thomas Wolfe about October and the tumbling leaves of bitter red, or yellow leaves like living light. And Adam was sad again, thinking of his father as a writer and how his life had changed, how it had been necessary for him to give up all that and become another person altogether, how all of them had become other persons, his father, his mother, and himself. Paul Del Monte. Poor, lost Paul Del Monte. They stopped to eat at a McDonald's because Adam had a weakness for hamburgers, and then they resumed the journey, and the sun came out now and then. His father suggested that they find a motel before darkness fell, and then go out to a good restaurant later. His father wasn't fond of McDonald's, and had toyed indifferently with the fish fillet. "Look," his mother said. They looked. It wasn't really a motel, but a string of cabins set back from the road, with a sign near the roadway that said, "Rest a While Motel." "Why not stay there?" his mother asked. "It looks more romantic than those antiseptic motels." "Right," his father said, steering the car off the road. His father made arrangements while he and his mother stayed in the car. When his father returned, he said, "There's one big cabin that can accommodate three people. They'll bring in a cot. That way we can stay together." Again, that small shiver along Adam's flesh. But they had a fine time that night. They found a restaurant called the Red Mill by a rustling brook, complete with an old water wheel, and his father and mother were in a good mood, his mother not so sad, a smile sometimes lingering at the corners of her lips. "Wine does this to her, makes her smile a lot," his father said, amused. Adam felt a sense of sharing. He was glad now that his father had told him all the secrets. He felt as though he were part of the family. Once, in a rush of affection,
He placed his hand over his mother's hand and squeezed. She smiled. Not the wine smile, but her old smile of tenderness and love and contentment. He looked at his father. It was impossible to squeeze his hand, of course, not at this age. But he regarded him with warmth and affection. Later, they made an adventure of the cabin, arranging the furniture to accommodate the cot. It reminded Adam of an old movie he'd seen on television. It happened one night, with Clark Gable and some actress, Claudette somebody, and his father and mother remembered the movie too, and it was good talking and joking and reminiscing, and then settling down. Adam lay awake long after his parents were asleep, listening to the night noises, listening to their breathing, his father's rhythmic snoring, his mother's fluttering breath. The next morning, they planned to head far to the north, to Burlington and St. Albans, and even farther to the Canadian border, although his father said they couldn't cross the border, of course. He said that Barry was on the road north, a stonecutter's town where Italians years ago had come to work on the quarries, reminiscent of Blunt, and it might be interesting to visit there. So they set out on the road to Barry, on a brilliant October morning, the leaves a riot of color. The road was a state highway, but not a major interstate. Sweeping, climbing curves greeted them, and majestic landscapes unfolded in the distance, with farmhouses and barns scattered here and there in the vistas. "It would be lonely if we weren't together," his mother said.
"I think there's a car following us," his father said. He spoke so calmly and so matter-of-factly, as if commenting on the weather or something, that the meaning of his words had no immediate impact on Adam.
"I saw it this morning across the street from the cabin at the gas station," his father said, still cool, still calm.
"Let's not panic. I'm going to slow down and pull toward the side of the road, as if we want to look at the view, and we'll see what happens."
Adam felt his mother stiffen.
"What do you think it is, Dad?"
"It could be anybody at all. Somebody like us, meandering around the countryside. Or it could be Gray's men. He likes to act the part of watchdog. For our own good, he says."
"Be careful, Dave," his mother said.
His father slowed the car at an apron of dirt at the side of the road, not too big for parking, but far enough off the side of the road so that they could look out at the countryside, farmlands in the distance, buildings like small toys. The car that his father said had been following them, a tan Dodge of no outstanding style, drove leisurely by without hesitation, going neither fast nor slow. Two men were in the front seat. They looked straight ahead as the car passed. Adam's father shook his head.
"Gray's men," he said wryly. "I'd know them anywhere. Never any privacy."
"Let's be glad it's them," his mother said. They pushed on, the tan Dodge out of sight, and the scenery grew more dramatic as the road climbed. In the far distance, a mountain swept toward the sky, its peak gleaming in the sunlight.
"Oh, David," his mother exclaimed.
They had rounded a curve and encountered a breathtaking vista, the edge of a roadway like a balcony looking out on miles and miles of countryside, a river below twisting like a thin black snake through the mottled earth. His father brought the car to a halt at the edge of the road.
"Let's stretch our legs," he said.
"I have a feeling we can see Canada," his mother said, tossing her hand toward the distance as they walked toward the view. That was when they heard the sound of a car. Fast, accelerating, whining. A sound erupting out of nowhere. Adam spun around. Not a car out of nowhere, but from around a nearby curve. A car hurtling toward them, metal flashing in the sun. The car was upon them, sickeningly. Adam screamed. Or had his mother screamed? He turned as if to run, and then turned back again and heard a scream. Whose? Cut off in mid-breath. He saw...
10-second interval.
Nothing.
You saw something, of course you did.
Yes.
What did you see?
The car, like a monster, The car.
What else?
Nothing. Just the car.
And what did the car do?
A bowling ball, like a bowling ball. Smashing. Crashing.
Into what? Into whom? 10-second interval. You must say it. 5-second interval. You must not stop now. 6-second interval. You must not stop now.
Into them. Into his father, his mother, himself. The car smashing, shattering. A flash of steel, sun glinting, and he felt himself, crazily, moving through the air. No feeling, no pain, no sense of flight, but actually in the air. Not flying, but moving as if in slow motion. Everything slowed down, tumbling now and twisting, and in the tumbling and the twisting, he saw his mother die. Instantly. Death, without any doubt. And he regarded her almost curiously. Numb, without feeling. One moment she was spinning the way he was spinning, like a top released from its string. And suddenly she was actually on the hood of the car, sliding, sliding toward the windshield in that terrible kind of slow motion. And then she was sliding back toward the front of the car, as if someone had reversed the film projector. And she fell to the pavement, not sliding off, but plunging to the pavement strangely, awkwardly, her head at an odd angle, almost at a right angle to her body. She stared at him with startled eyes, but she was not really staring at him, because Adam knew the eyes were sightless, vacant. She was dead, irrevocably dead, the knowledge irrefutable as he lay on the pavement now. His own strange flight ended somehow. He didn't know how, he didn't know when he had stopped moving in the air. And he continued to stare at her, unable to move, unable to talk, unable to do anything. And he felt all wet and oozy, as if he were lying in a swamp. And he was aware of something warm and wet encompassing him as he looked at his mother, her head at that wrong angle, a rag doll tossed away. A voice. He got away, he's not here. Another voice. I saw him run, he's hurt. Another voice. They'll get him. They never miss. His father. They were talking about his father. His father had to get away. He clung to the thought. Pounding feet now, echoing on the pavement, and the echoes loud because his ear was pressed to the pavement. His cheek felt bruised, lacerated. And he was still facing his mother, and she was still dead, of course, her head at that peculiar angle. He didn't want to look at her anymore. He lay, numb, in a vacuum except for the echo of sounds in his ears, and he tried to raise his head from the pavement, but couldn't. And he wanted to close his eyes, but couldn't. And he couldn't bear to look at his mother anymore. He did not want to look at her anymore. She was dead. He felt a need to move, to get up, to raise himself from the pavement, to turn. He exerted all his strength, all his determination, the pavement scratching his cheek like sandpaper as he moved, and he finally turned his head slightly and swiveled his eyes to see.
What did you see?
Him. Him, walking toward him and his mother, tall. Saw him tall, taller than ever, because he looked tallest of all from the pavement, and his mouth was moving as he came, walking, walking.
Tell me. It's important.
Coming closer, looming. Closer still, his legs like a giant's legs, like someone on stilts, maybe. And hearing the words coming from his mouth now, he'll never get away. But he will. His father had to get away.
The legs moved toward his mother, and the mouth spoke.
She's terminated.
Hearing the words and not wanting to hear them, seeing him come closer, the legs walking toward him again, hovering over him now.
Who did you see?
Gray pants. Him. Hearing his voice again.
Move fast. Remove her. The boy, check him. He may be useful. Fast now, fast.
Hands grappled his body, but there was still no pain, and a sudden weariness engulfed him. A sweet and delicious weariness enveloped him, caressing him, and he gave himself up to it. His face heavy now, and his eyes heavy, and the weariness was beautiful, taking him, gathering him. His eyes fluttered like his mother's breath had fluttered long ago, and he rose up to the weariness, and then settled down into it, soft and gentle and tender.
Who? Who? 5 second interval. You must not retreat now. 5 second interval. You must not withdraw. 5 second interval. Can you respond? Are you able to respond? 5 second interval. Lift your hand if you can respond. 30 second interval. Let the record show no response. End tape OZK-015.
I turn the corner, and I'm in Rotterburg. I pedal along, refreshed and at ease in the cool of the morning. Rotterburg is deserted, not a soul in sight, as if everyone's been wiped out by a science fiction holocaust. I pedal smoothly, my arms and legs moving beautifully, coordinated, and it seems as if pedaling the bike is second nature now, part of my existence, something I was born to do. I look for a telephone booth, but I don't see any. I'm not sure why I want to find a phone booth. In fact, the thought of a phone booth makes me sad. I don't know why it makes me sad, but it does. It opens up a loneliness in me, like a hole, a deep, dark hole. The hole is threatening somehow. If it gets too big, it could swallow me up, so I try not to think about it. I turn the corner and see the hospital. The iron gates gleam in the sun. They were recently painted a hideous orange, but Dr. DuPont says this is only the undercoating. The gates will be painted black again later. I pedal toward the gates, and I am glad to be back. My legs are getting stiff now, and my fingers are numb. I reach the gates, and Dr. DuPont is waiting for me. He is always waiting for me. He is a big man with white hair and a sad black mustache, and his voice is always soft, always gentle.
"Well, you're here,"
he says, and he is glad to see me. I get off the bike with a flourish to show him how expert I am. I glance outside through the gates. Someday I will ride my bike out there. "I didn't take the medicine, doctor," I tell him. It's very cold now, and my body begins to tremble. He places his arm around my shoulder. "That's all right," he murmurs. I push my bike along the path that leads to the hospital, and he walks along beside me. The hospital is on a small hill in front of us, a white building with black shutters and columns in front, like a southern mansion.
"Welcome back, Skipper,"
someone calls. I look up to see Mr. Harvester, the old maintenance man. His voice is loud and he smiles at me and I smile back. He mows the lawn and does odd jobs and he's always planning trips somewhere, reading books and maps and travel magazines, but he never goes anywhere. The red veins in his face resemble the road maps he's always reading. The doctor and I continue to walk, and I am tired suddenly. All that riding...
"Well, what do you know?"
The traveler's back, Whipper says. He is on the porch with his two friends, Dobie and Lewis. They're wise guys. I don't look at them. They're always playing pranks. Once, when I was riding the bike around the grounds, Dr. DuPont allows me to do this if I promise not to leave the place. Whipper and his friends chased me and knocked me off, and I went flying into a ditch. Whipper is staring at me as I go by, and there's a smirk on his face. I don't look at him, but I know the smirk is there. He's always trying to steal my box from me. As we go by Whipper, I clutch the box tightly. Inside, the smell of lilac fills the hallway as usual. Dr. DuPont tries to keep the place homelike. This is not an institution, but a home, a haven for troubled people, he says. I hear a growl as we proceed down the hall. I'm tired, as if I haven't slept for a long time, and when I hear the growl of the dog, I'm almost too tired to be afraid. Now, now, Dr. DuPont says, everything's all right. He calls into the other room. Get Silver out of here. I told you to keep him outdoors. Silver is a German shepherd, and he's ferocious. He delights in chasing people and knocking them down. He chases me whenever I ride my bike. We pass the office at the end of the hallway where Luke, the switchboard operator, is usually stationed. Sometimes Luke helps to serve the meals, and he often gives me extra portions to build me up physically. I wave to him as we pass, and he waves back, nodding his head, the mouthpiece clamped to his chin. Dr. DuPont and I climb the stairs, and Arthur Haynes leans over, watching our progress up the spiral staircase. Arthur Haynes is big and fat and always perspiring. He doesn't say anything, but he watches us go up, and he looks sad. He's always scratching himself. He gives me the creeps. Arthur Haynes always stays on the second floor, behind the banister, and his eyes follow everybody. I try not to let my eyes meet his. We reach the top of the stairs and begin walking toward my room, and although I don't like it here and I feel somehow that I don't belong here, there is a feeling of belonging, of being among familiar things. I know that Junior Varney lurks somewhere and will try to steal my bike. I know the bad times in the night. I know about that room where they will ask me questions. But I'm tired, and I'm glad my room is waiting. My room is small and comfortable, with blue wallpaper, gold birds flying on the blue. Dr. DuPont goes to my bureau and returns with the medicine. I swallow the two pills and drink the water. I sit in the chair and look at the window. Frost edges the window pane. My father, I say, looking at the window. There are no bars on the window, not like that other room where I sit and answer questions. I hope I don't have to go there anymore. Is my father dead? I ask. Please, Dr. DuPont says, relax now. Let the medicine do its work. Then we'll talk. His voice is soothing, like syrup, not like that other voice in that other room. I don't want to think about that other room, but I keep thinking about my father. My father is dead, isn't he? I ask. I know that my mother is dead. I have knowledge that she is dead. I don't know how, but I do. But my father is different. I wonder if he's out there somewhere, waiting for me to find him. I wonder if he's out there somewhere hurt, injured, waiting for me to bring him help. We are all mortal, Dr. DuPont says, his voice gentle. We must all die someday. His voice is so gentle that I lean back in the chair. My poor father, I say. He is dead, isn't he? He didn't get away, did he? The doctor's face is sad. His face is always sad when we talk about my father, and I find out again that he is dead. The doctor takes the package from my hand, and I begin to sing. The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell, hi-ho the merry-o, the farmer in the dell. It makes me feel good when I sing. I watch Dr. DuPont as I sing. He's opening the box. He's a kind man. The medicine is working now, and I can feel it in my veins. It's singing in my veins along with me. The child takes the cat, the child takes the cat. Hi-ho the merry-o, the child takes the cat. I'm singing fine now, because I know that I don't have to go into that room and answer the questions. Maybe later, of course, but not now at least. The cat takes the rat, the cat takes the rat. Hi-ho the merry-o, the cat takes the rat. The doctor opens the box and takes out Pokey the pig, my old friend. The doctor is a good man, and he found Pokey the pig for me. He went away and found it, and also found my father's old army jacket and his old hat. He places Pokey the pig in my arms. The rat takes the cheese, the rat takes the cheese. Hi-ho the merry-o, the rat takes the cheese. I rock Pokey in my arms, and I'm wearing my father's jacket, and I have on his old cap, and now I'm not so sad anymore, although I know he's dead, and my mother's dead, too. I keep singing. I keep singing. The cheese stands alone, the cheese stands alone. Hi-ho the merry-o, the cheese stands alone. Rest a while, Dr. DuPont says. Everything's going to be all right, Paul. I wonder who the doctor is talking to. This somebody he calls Paul. Who is Paul? I know I'm not Paul. There is another name I know about, but I can't think of the name now. And anyway, I'm too busy singing, and I hold Pokey the pig close to me, and I smile as I sing, because I know, of course, who I am, who I will always be. I am the cheese.
Tape OZK-016-1655. Date deleted. T. Annual report on file data 865-01. Special references. Subject A. Personnel number 2222. Agency basic procedures. As evidenced in attached tapes, OZK series, it was impossible to elicit from Subject A information sought by Department 1R. Inducement of medication. Refer medical unit group. Plus pre-knowledge interrogation failed to bring forth suspected knowledge of Subject A. Psychiatric reports. Refer psychiatric profiles plus analyses. Corroborate results of OZK series tapes. Subject A responded with consistency of earlier sessions. Refer Department B2 tape series ORT-UDW. Data provided by Subject A also consistent with earlier reactions. Deep withdrawal when topics which concern Department 1R are approached. Refer Witness Reestablishment Project file data 865-01. Witness number 599-6. Results of questioning, negative. Refer negative results in tape series ORT-UDW. Summary. This is the third annual questioning of Subject A, with results identical to two earlier sessions, at 12-month intervals. Subject A discloses no awareness of data provided Department 1R by witness number 599-6. Complete withdrawal accompanies recapitulation of termination of witness 599-6 and affiliate, spouse. Knowledge, however, may be psychological residue within Subject A. Advisory. Department B-2 holds no authority under input for recommendations and functions as advisory. The following advisories are advanced for priority study. Advisory number 1. Modification of agency basic procedures to eliminate policy 979, which does not currently allow termination procedures by Department 1R. Advisory number 2. Discontinue suspension of personnel number 2222 and grant full reinstatement on following basis. While it is fact that witness number 599-6 had been located by adversaries, it has not been established that personnel number 2222 allowed termination of witness 599-6 and affiliate, spouse, by adversaries. There is only circumstantial evidence that personnel number 2222 contacted adversaries regarding location of witness 599-6. Note that personnel number 2222 directed post-termination activity with efficiency and dispatch as follows. A. Pursuit and confirmation of witness number 599-6 termination by adversaries. B. Removal of affiliate's remains from scene. C. Transfer of subject A to confinement facilities. All activities completed without involvement of local authorities. Third-year mandatory review indicates personnel number 2222 acted within existing policies of agency basic procedures. Advisory number 3. Since Subject A is final linkage between witness number 599-6 and file data 865-01, it is advised that A, pending revision of agency basic procedures, refer policy 979, Subject A's confinement be continued until termination procedures are approved, or B, Subject A's condition be sustained until Subject A obliterates. End tape series OZK-016.
I am riding the bicycle, and I am on Route 31 in Monument, Massachusetts, on my way to Rutterburg, Vermont, and I'm pedaling furiously because this is an old-fashioned bike. No speeds, no fenders, only the warped tires and the brakes that don't always work, and the handlebars with cracked rubber grips to steer with. A plain bike, the kind my father rode as a kid years ago. It's cold as I pedal along, and the wind like a snake slithering up my sleeves and into my jacket and my pants legs, too. But I keep pedaling. I keep pedaling.
The End. You've been listening to I Am the Cheese by Robert Cormier, narrated by Jeff Woodman and John Randolph Jones. Robert Cormier is the recipient of the Young Adult Services Division School Library Journal Author Award, which recognizes authors whose books have provided young adults with a window through which they can view their world and which will help them grow and to understand themselves and their role in society. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Chocolate War, also by Robert Cormier, narrated unabridged by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order another recorded book or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1 800 638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.